This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Ross Reynolds. Why is more wealth concentrated in the richest Americans? Why have increases in worker productivity not led to higher wages? Well, many would argue that the decline of the American labor movement is one big reason. After World War II, one in three workers belonged to a union. Today, it's more like one in 10. And most of those union members are government employees. Only one in 20 people employed in the private sector are in unions. Jake Rosenfeld, a professor of sociology at the University of Washington, examines these questions in his new book. It's called What Unions No Longer Do. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on. It's a real pleasure.
You talk about some of the problems with unions, but it might be good to remind people about what unions have done. What can American workers thank unions for?
Oh, sure. A wide range of developments in the American labor market is a direct consequence of the American labor movement, especially during the kind of middle decades of the 20th century. Things like the 40-hour work week, things like overtime pay, things like the weekend. Those are all developments pushed, prodded, and fought for by a strong, vital labor movement, one that has declined precipitously since that period.
Your first line in this book is that the only big thing about big labor is its problems. So what are these big problems facing big labor?
That's right. So they've had, you know, a precipitous decline in dues-paying members. And we should be clear here that up until the last year or so ago, the decline of the American labor movement was entirely a private sector phenomenon. So a decline from about one in three down to about one in every 20 private sector workers today. And government unions, public sector unions, remain relatively strong, and emphasis is on relatively there. Still about a third of the public sector remains organized today, but they've seen sustained attacks across the United States and even in traditionally strong union states such as Michigan, such as Illinois, and Wisconsin, famously. So the problems that labor faces are manifold. They have had a steep decline in dues-paying members, a dramatic reduction in political power and their ability to kind of shape policy, something that was one of their kind of key tasks for decades and decades. And we could go on all afternoon.
Well, are any of these problems that unions face self-inflicted?
I think that's it's an important question, and it's absolutely the case that there is a complacency in the labor movement for some time, especially when they had reached an organization rate of about a third, many U.S. union leaders thought that they had really organized the American labor force, and there was really little else to do when it came to signing up new members. And then that coincided with a dramatic attack on organized labor, along with some economic and political developments that put labor on the defensive, and many unions weren't prepared for that. I think that's the case.
That attack from where, and why was it successful?
Sure. So during the 70s and the early 1980s, there's a global recession. This is the time of kind of rising globalization, technological changes. These developments put organized labor, labor movements on the defensive throughout the developed world, right, across nation after nation. In the U.S., the decline was even steeper, right? So I think some decline was probably inevitable, but not nearly the decline that we've experienced. And that was due to a really concerted effort by American businesses. They got organized, and they put real pressure on unions, either shed in efforts to shed existing unions and prevent new unionization campaigns. And businesses were aided by a political turn to the right that this political development prevented any new significant piece of pro-labor legislation from being passed that would have helped labor rebalance the playing field a bit.
Jake Rosenfeld, professor of sociology at the University of Washington, is talking about his book, What Unions No Longer Do. And let's cut to the chase. Your main point here is that what unions no longer do is provide some protection for working people and do something to reduce the inequality in America. Is that a fair summary of your point?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You simply cannot understand what's been happening in terms of inequality and many different dimensions of inequality in this country without accounting for the dramatic decline of organized labor.
We have here in Western Washington a fairly labor-strong area, and yet there have been setbacks here. Most recently, the Boeing company asked for a renegotiation of a contract and were able to get significant givebacks from the very powerful machinists union. What does that signify, and how does that fit into the larger picture of labor's decline?
Yeah, I think it's both kind of part and parcel of what we've seen across the much of the private sector over the last couple of decades, but also interesting in some new ways. So there is a lot of press coverage of the machinist dispute, and a lot of it focused on changes in the healthcare package and then a kind of radical reshaping of the pension package. What wasn't covered all that much was the really small wage increases, right? Raises guaranteed over the life of the contract. Wage increases of about a percent, half a percent to a percent each year. And these increases are disconnected from the health of Boeing as a company. And this here kind of helps, it kind of makes clear why we've seen over the last couple of decades the dramatic disconnect between average productivity levels in the economy and average wages.
And yet Boeing's argument was, look, we might be doing okay on our balance books today, but we've got tough competition down the line. We really have to cut our expenses to the bone. That was their counter argument.
Absolutely. And I think for a lot of industries out there, that in a lot of highly competitive industries, that counter argument would really make clear sense. It just doesn't make sense in the aerospace industry. We're talking about effectively a duopoly. There's two main players here, and Boeing's competition is not anchored in Bangladesh, right? Their headquarters are in France and Germany with highly paid, organized workforces.
The other interesting thing that labor's been doing here in Western Washington is jumping in with both feet into the call for a higher minimum wage, not just here in Western Washington, but across the country. It's particularly strong here with the city of SeaTac approving it, and President Obama calling for a higher minimum wage, Governor Inslee, Mayor Ed Murray joining the call for a $15 an hour minimum wage here. And the Service Employees International Union has been really a strong backer of this movement all over the country. What would the success of getting a higher minimum wage mean to the labor movement?
I think it's unclear at this point. I mean, on the one hand, it would be a tangible victory, and we've already seen some victories in certain states that have recently raised their minimum wages, and these were campaigns oftentimes underwritten, and the organizational support came from labor unions. But what unions haven't figured out how to do quite yet is how to translate these policy victories into increasing their ranks, right, into adding more dues-paying members, because finally union coffers will run dry, and they've put up a lot of money and a lot of effort into these campaigns. And it's important to keep in mind here that a fact about organized labor in the U.S. as elsewhere that's often overlooked is that the vast majority, you can look at Boeing machinists, of union members are not themselves low-wage workers, right? Yet they spend all this time and all this money fighting on behalf of kind of broad-based prosperity, shared prosperity from the bottom on up.
Where are unions still strong and thriving in the world?
You look at the Scandinavian nations with unionization rates well above 50%. And then throughout Western Europe, you have still very strong organized countries, countries like Germany and countries like France. And even if you look to our neighbor to the north, Canada's union movement has certainly fallen on tough times in recent decades, but they hum along with a unionization rate about 2 to 3 times that of our own, and much lower inequality, partly as a result.
You would say because the unions remain strong there, there's less inequality in society?
I think absolutely, because Canada was a country that, like the United States, made the transition from a manufacturing-based economy to a service-based economy, underwent globalization, technological changes. All those are similar, yet they have much lower inequality. And I think the main culprit would have to be a stronger labor movement.
So why have other countries sustained strong labor movements and, if you're correct, lower inequality while the United States has not?
I think there are a lot of antecedents there, and I think the American labor movement, compared to a lot of these other countries, was just always more fragile. It didn't have as much support from important business interests. The kind of business opposition to organized labor in the United States is somewhat unparalleled. And then finally, in recent decades, the political opposition has just really kind of in conjunction with business opposition, has just made it almost impossible to organize in the private sector. If you're a business owner today, given the state of American labor law, and you're absolutely committed to keeping a union out of your company, there's really nothing standing in your way.
But do we know why businesses in, say, Scandinavia or Canada or Western Europe have been less hostile to unions than they have been here? There are big businesses there. They want to make a decent profit also.
Right. And this is, I think, a fundamental question and one that we just don't have a fantastic answer to. Partly it's ideological. Partly it's the structure of these various labor movements. In places like Scandinavia, or if you look even to a place like Germany, labor movements are much more centralized and work in concert with businesses across industry after industry, deciding, you know, looking forward, projecting forward a year or two down the line, what would be better? Should we restrain wage growth now, in turn, you know, given if business climate turns down? In the United States, we've always had a much more fractured, decentralized labor movement, pitting individual locals versus individual establishments. And that seems to have made for a much more contentious bargaining environment than we see in many other places.
You know, there are those who argue that in certain areas, unions are still tremendously powerful in influencing politics. They'll look at K-12 education, for example. Right now in this state, there's an effort to try to include student test scores as part of a teacher evaluation. It's being vigorously fought by the Washington Education Association. And in the past, that union has been very successful in blunting things that it thought were hostile to their members and encouraging things that were useful for their members. Are there still some areas where unions still have a lot of clout?
I think that's right. And you have to look to the public sector to see those areas. And so teachers' unions remain very powerful in certain jurisdictions across the country. But we've seen recently in recent years a kind of bipartisan attack on a lot of teachers' unions' prerogatives. And so, you know, if I had to project forward the next 5 to 10 years, you'll see more of these attacks, and some of them will prove successful. They will break the ranks in certain areas.
The UW's Jake Rosenfeld telling us about his book, What Unions No Longer Do. Jake, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.